Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Here's a question to think about. Do you trust your government? What about your government? Does it trust you? On today's show, the relationship between our elected leaders and us. Disapproval rates of Congress at all-time lows. Gridlock, indecision. Can we change the trust dynamic? And what does it mean going forward? And then later in the hour, census results find a surprising trend. Men are making a population comeback in Michigan. We'll look at what's behind the numbers. But first, the group Keep Michigan Wolves Protected has filed language with the Secretary of State to put another petition on the 2014 ballot. The group wants to ban wolf hunting in Michigan. If the language is approved, the group would try to collect more than 160,000 signatures to put the question to voters. Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, joins us now. And Rick, this all gets a little confusing.
A little bit.
All right. We want to try to break this all down. So Keep Michigan Wolves Protected, earlier this year, had collected enough signatures to put a referendum on a state law that designated the wolf as a game species. We talked to a representative of that group. But then the legislature passed another law that would make that referendum meaningless because it gave the Natural Resources Commission the authority to decide which animals could be hunted, almost like check and checkmate. So what would this new ballot do?
Well, and this new law doesn't just give the Natural Resources Commission the authority to name game species. It also actually puts the wolf into the game species list. So the Natural Resources Commission action on that was not even necessary. And so Keep Michigan Wolves Protected, the Humane Society, the groups that are behind this, are saying that this is cheating. It was sidestepping the original referendum because the people who wanted this could no longer get their way. And so what they say is, so we're going to go back to the ballot. And if we have to put a second referendum for people to vote on in November 2014, that's what we're going to do.
So if they do get that number of signatures, does that mean then we'll see two different ballot questions on wolves come November 2014?
There will be two referendum on hunting and on wolf hunting, and there could conceivably be other ballot questions as well, maybe put on by the legislature to affirm hunting rights in Michigan. So we could see a whole lot of hunting on the November 2014 ballot.
Now, either way, what Keep Michigan Wolves Protected is trying to do will not stop a hunt that's scheduled for this fall. Am I correct?
In theory, it could happen, but Keep Michigan Wolves Protected does not think that they have enough time to collect the roughly 225,000 signatures that they need in time to get it turned into elections officials and have the law suspended before that wolf hunt in November, which also means that, you know, come November, I think we're going to see a lot of activity in the Western Upper Peninsula from people who are both for wolf hunting and against wolf hunting, that you'll see, you know, literally activists out in the woods trying to find pictures and videos of wolves that have got their paws caught in traps and things like that. The State Department of Natural Resources and the Natural Resources Commission and hunting rights advocates will try to use the experience of the November wolf hunt as proof that it is wise wildlife management. So that's what we'll probably see in November.
And finally, Rick, are there any other legal tracks that the anti-wolf hunt folks are thinking about?
Well, there is a consortium of Indian tribes, the Chippewa Ottawa Resource Authority, and this is a group that was created as part of a game and fishing treaty with the state, and they're asking the state to scientifically justify the wolf hunt and to show them, you know, to show the tribes the justification for it. And if the tribes are not satisfied that the justification is there, then there's a process that's laid out in the treaty that includes arbitration, mediation. It could eventually include legal action, court action to do something about the wolf hunt. So that's sort of where things stand right now.
Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. As always, Rick, thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Cindy.
Thousands of Michigan college students got very unwelcome news over the past week or so. Tuition going up at many Michigan universities and colleges, and then interest rates on some of their loans will double. This 1-2 punch of soaring costs and rising debt is being felt in many, many homes around Michigan. You know, there are more than 300,000 students in Michigan with those federal loans, and the number of people taking out student loans and the amount they're taking on, that continues to climb. Well, we wanted to get behind those headlines and look at just what all of this means to a typical college student in our state. Joining us is Darren Camilleri. Darren's a student at Kalamazoo College. He's also the acting president of the Michigan Federation of College Democrats. Welcome, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
You felt so strongly about your loan situation that you recently published a piece in the Huffington Post, and it focuses on hashtag don't double my rate.
That's right.
What's your message?
Well, for me, I'm going to be graduating from Kalamazoo College next year with $27,000 in student loans. And for me, that's going to be a huge burden when I graduate because, you know, the job market still isn't that great. And I don't know what my opportunities are going to be. And I'm going to have to start paying that debt right away. But with this next loan that I'm going to have for my senior year, the rate's going to double, and it's going to be costing me an extra at least $1,000. Some estimates go as much as $2,600 on the loan. And I don't know what that means for me because I'm a first-generation college student. And for me, the American dream and going to college is supposed to be what we're aiming for, but it seems like Congress is making it pretty unaffordable.
What does it mean for you to be the very first in your family to graduate with a college degree?
It's everything. My family has placed a lot of investment into me and my education. I come from Downriver, which has a lot of blue-collar working-class families. My dad works in the auto industry. He works for Ford. And my entire family, they only know the auto industry. So for me, this is the first – I'll be the first person to go out of the auto economy and try to step into the creative economy, which is this 21st century economy that we're trying to develop here in Michigan and across the country. And so for me, this is everything.
So as this story unfolded with the Senate failing to act in time to keep the rates on those Stafford loans from doubling, what does that say to you and to other college students?
It says to me that Congress and some senators, particularly Republican senators, aren't willing to put education first. They tell us over and over again that college is something that we're supposed to be aiming for. It's the only way that you can get ahead in the 21st century economy. But they're not making it affordable. They're not making it an option for a lot of people. They're making it more expensive, more unattainable. And to me, it seems like Congress just isn't working for students.
Now, I know that in your piece in the Huffington Post, you talk about something that particularly has you upset, and that's the fact that the government's making money off those student loans. Talk to us about that.
Yeah. Last year, the government made $50 billion on our student loans. And with this increase, they're expected to make another $21 billion on the backs of students. And it's something that I don't think is fair. They want us to be going out and being the first people to start building up a new economy, mm-hmm. but they're putting all this debt on the backs of students that we just can't afford. And we can't afford to be paying for things like tax cuts to corporations that ship jobs overseas, or if we're still paying down the war in Iraq. And that's something that I think needs to change, is that students can't be paying for the government's debt.
Well, let me just ask you, though, isn't that what lenders everywhere do? They lend money to make money?
And I don't think that the government shouldn't make any money off of it, but the amount of money that they're making is a little it's huge. $50 billion last year, another $21 billion. When does it end? They keep raising the interest rates to 8% and just keep trying to make up all this money on the backs of students? I don't know. It doesn't make much sense to me.
Now, we've seen headlines about tuition increases around Michigan that the U of M Regents approved a 1.1% tuition increase. Wayne State looking for 9%, Michigan State University tuition going up, EMU Regents okay to 3.75% increase. What about your situation at Kalamazoo College?
We have had our tuition increased about 4% this coming year. We've had about 4% every year that I've been there. Since we're a private institution, it's a little bit different, mm-hmm. so we don't get state funds. But still having a continuous increase in the tuition is just making it even more unaffordable. And it's just making it harder and harder for students to be able to access that college education.
And then when you talk to college and university leaders, they point to the fact that aid from Lansing has been consistently cut down. What would you want decision makers in Lansing to know about the situation that you and other college students find yourself in?
Well, first of all, I'm still one of the young people that was promised the Michigan Promise Scholarship. And it's something that I think a lot of us don't necessarily forget. Is that money was promised to us when I was a kid, when I was a teenager. And my parents knew that Promise Scholarship was going to be there, but then it got cut. Mm-hmm. So that was the first step. The second step is they're cutting funding to education at colleges and universities. My brother is going to be attending Saginaw Valley State University in the fall. He's taking out federal loans. The state has been cutting funding to colleges like Saginaw, and it's going to be making it more and more expensive to go there. I just don't see what the disconnect for the leaders in Lansing. How do they think that we're supposed to survive in this new economy if they're making it more and more expensive to go to college?
Darren Camilleri is a student at Kalamazoo College. His piece in HuffPost Detroit is hashtag don't double my rate isn't over just yet. Good luck and thanks for talking with us today at Stateside.
Thank you.
And here at Stateside, we really want to connect with you. We especially would love to hear from our new Interlochen Public Radio listeners. And it's really easy to find us online. You can go to michiganradio.org and click on the link that says Stateside. You can go to Facebook and search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and that's spelled C-A-N-T-Y. And of course, we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. So let us know what you think, what stories you'd like us to cover. We'd love to hear from you. Still to come, trust. It's lacking between our government and us. Just what will it take to improve the climate of trust between voters and the leaders we elect? And what are the consequences if things don't get better? That conversation in 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Women of Michigan, something is going on. There seems to be a shift in the census data, and somehow, in some ways, it appears the men's team could be gaining ground on the women's team. Our go-to guy when it comes to crunching census data is Kurt Metzger. He's the director of Data Driven Detroit, and he joins us now. Welcome back to Stateside, Kurt.
Thanks so much. It's always great to be here.
Kurt, you stumbled across some stats that you say surprised even you. And you see statistics every single day. And you said, actually, surprisingly, even somebody who does this on a daily basis can be surprised.
Yes, I was surprised. I mean, it's one of those things when you have nothing better to do, you start looking at numbers. And when knowing full well that more men are born, more male babies are born, but that we lose our lead somewhere in our late teens, early 20s,
okay.
That was my assumption. The differences get larger and larger, more women over men.
So the men's lead traditionally erodes as we go through the years.
Right. We usually, I mean, what would happen is, and my assumption had been, that men outnumber women until their late teens, maybe early 20s, and then it becomes an issue of violent deaths, a lot more younger men dying from both homicide and other kinds of causes. And so all of a sudden, women take that lead in the early 20s, and then because of longer lifespans, continue to expand that lead so that by the time you get to 65 and over, the lead has gotten quite a bit larger, and then it just jumps tremendously when you get 75 and more.
So what did you find that made you go, whoa, things are changing?
Okay, so I started, you know, I looked at the numbers from 2012 that had come out, and I saw that that males all of a sudden were maintaining a lead up until, at least in Michigan, up until the age of 29, and I thought, wait a second, this doesn't make a lot of sense. And so I started going back, and I went back to 1940, which was the earliest report I had on my shelves that I could really start to check. And I noticed that actually up through from 1940 to 1980, men had that lead up until the age of 18, and then women took over in 19 and continued to expand their lead. By 1990, it jumped to 19, so it finally added a year. Men did pick up a year.
Uh-huh.
But actually, by 2000, for whatever reason, I'm still trying to figure that out, men basically held a lead up through 35 years of age. So they, with a couple exceptions, but they jumped after going nowhere for about 40 years and then picking up 1 year, all of a sudden there was a 16-year jump.
That's a huge jump.
And it is. It is. I thought so. I thought, boy, oh boy, what's going on here? So, you know, started to think about, well, what might have happened. And I still don't have all the answers. I know that men are living longer. At least their lifespan is growing a little bit faster. I think women are starting, again, with the increasing education, more women in the workforce, more women smoking than men, these kinds of issues around stress and everything. So we're seeing that men are starting to pick up a little bit on the lifespan. But I think what happened, and the only thing that I could easily put my hand on, was that we had this tremendous immigration during the 1990s. I mean, that was where we saw the huge immigration nationally and certainly in Michigan, a large foreign-born population. And when you look at the numbers, you also see, you know, kind of in the distribution of race, you see that there's this bubble that the population gets more diverse as you get younger, and then there's this kind of jump up in the early 20s because you have this immigration numbers, and that jumps up the mix, the diversity population, and then kind of drops back down in the late teens. So what I also see is that men tend to outnumber women in terms of immigrants. So it's usually younger males, usually 25 maybe to 39. Some of that is college attendance, but most of it is young males coming over here and as that first wave of immigrants, and then either bringing a family, bringing someone else back, or marrying once they get here. And we also have seen a lot of secondary migration. So a number of immigrants went to other states and then found their way to Michigan.
Kurt, explain to us from where you sit why it's so important to study and analyze data like this?
Well, I think obviously a lot of people are interested in various demographic trends. I mean, certainly recently we've been talking about how does Michigan attract young, educated population? How do we retain people who are coming out of college? How do we attract college-educated people? How do we keep a young? How do we get millennials? How do we kind of increase that population? Because of what it means for attracting businesses, for entrepreneurial growth, and just for the dynamics of the fact that we have been seeing fewer and fewer births. We need more young people to start to have children and increase that population as well. I think, you know, if we can advertise more males in these age groups, we may be able to attract young females coming from other parts of the country where maybe their odds aren't so great, so we can always advertise that. But it's these kinds of characteristics that we have to understand. We have a state that is aging very rapidly, aging faster than any state in the country, and we have to start to turn those trends around. And we have to make sure that we understand what is attracting young people, what do we need to do to emphasize and to increase those numbers. It's just interesting here that we've seen this kind of change in terms of the male female ratios at certain ages, and it's always interesting to try to figure out why is that happening, what does that portend for the future, are there ways that we can use this information to benefit the state and benefit some of our urban areas as well.
Kurt Metzger, Director of Data Driven Detroit. Always great to talk with you, Kurt. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
For centuries and centuries, we've been fascinated by the night sky. So as we relax into the summer months, we decided we'd spend a little time taking a look at what we'll see when we look up at the summer night sky here in Michigan. Michael Narlock joins us now. He's head of astronomy at the Cranbrook Institute of Science. Hi, Michael.
How are you?
Very, very well, and ready to talk stars with you. But before we get into what there is to see in Michigan's summer skies, I want to ask you if you're willing to share a little bit of private information. Where do you go when you want to look at the summer stars at night? And I'm talking about outside, not an observatory or planetarium.
Well, if you really want to see the nighttime sky as it's meant to be seen, the best place to go is probably the Upper Peninsula. There are very few city lights to contend with, and you'll see above you 6,000 to 10,000 stars in a pitch black environment, and it's awe inspiring.
It is. What kind of suggestions, if we will, do's or don'ts, do you give people who want to begin to understand and appreciate what they're looking at when they stargaze?
Well, probably the first thing that we tell them is don't invest in a telescope right away. Don't spend money on a high-end piece of equipment before you really know whether or not it's going to be something you're interested in. The best thing to do if you really want to get acquainted with the nighttime sky is join a local astronomy club. There you'll engage with veteran amateur astronomers who have been at this for 20, 30, 40 years, and they'll have telescopes that you can use. And you'll sort of go in at the ground floor to gain an appreciation of the nighttime sky. And you'll get a quick understanding of whether or not it's something you're willing to devote the time, energy, and resources to do.
You are an astronomer, so you are a professional in this. What do you think of the apps that are available for our smartphones? I've got the one that's called the Night Sky. Is that fairly reliable where you hold it up and it says, hey, guess what you're looking at?
Yeah, I mean, they're fairly reliable. I've not run across one that's been terrifically out of date or has the positions wrong. They all have their pros and cons, and you know, it's up to the individual user to determine which one they like best. But apps, for the most part, are a wonderful way, especially with smartphone apps, are a wonderful way for people to engage in the nighttime sky with something they can just click on. Now, the drawback, though, of using a smartphone is, by its very nature, when you turn it on, the screen illuminates your face, and it sort of ruins your night vision. So you're getting a sort of a poor man's planetarium experience when you use one of those apps.
At least I must say I find it kind of cool to be able to identify something other than the Big and Little Dipper, because I think for most of us it kind of stops with that.
pretty much does. People can readily identify the moon.
Yeah.
But you know, they are great tools when you see a bright dot in the sky in determining, is that a planet? Is it a bright star? They're wonderful for that.
I'm speaking with Michael Narlock. He's head of astronomy at the Cranbrook Institute of Science, and we are going to take a look now and talk about the skies themselves, and as we head into the summer months, what can we enjoy looking at in the skies in the Northern Hemisphere, and what's taking center stage in Michigan? So what are you excited about seeing over the summer in Michigan, Michael?
Saturn. Saturn's going to be in our early evening sky, and it is, of all the planets in the solar system, it is the one that captivates young and old alike. Because you see pictures of it in books or magazines or on television, and it has those wonderful rings. But when you look at Saturn through even a modest telescope, you can see those rings for yourself. A little bit more powerful telescope, you can actually see one of the moons of Saturn. It's just an amazing object to look at through a telescope, because you can actually see the rings around the planet.
If you don't have a telescope, does Saturn stand out as far as being bright?
Yeah, all the planets, the big ones, they tend to be brighter than the stars that they're around. So if you go out around 10 o'clock or so and look towards the south, you will definitely see a bright dot in the southern sky, and that would be the planet Saturn. It'll look a little yellowish, had a little bit of a yellowish tinge to it.
Ah, all right. And what else is going to be happening in the summer?
Well, unfortunately, the other planets are sort of clustered around the sun right now. Towards the end of the summer, Jupiter will be joining us in the morning sky, and that's a great one to look at because you can see actual features on its surface, these bands of gas that stretch across the surface. You can also see four of its 60-some-odd moons that encircle it. For those who are fans of the University of Michigan, there's actually a star called Albireo. It's in the constellation an asterism called the Summer Triangle, and we call it, here at Cranbrook, we call it the U of M star, because it's actually two stars in orbit around each other, and one of them is a gold color and the other one's a blue color.
Oh, very cool. And again, you can kind of get that even without a microscope or a telescope, right, as far as the sense of the color.
No, you need a telescope to see the color, but you can find the star certainly with just your eyes. But if you use even a small telescope, you can easily resolve them into two little dots of differing colors.
Now, I understand we should make a mark on our calendars to pay attention to some meteors around mid-August.
Yeah, there's a meteor shower that happens every year. Meteor showers generally happen the same time year every year, and August is definitely a good one. I don't know if it's going to be a shower, which means you'll have maybe 30 or 40 an hour that you'll see, or a storm, which means you could see hundreds and hundreds of meteors streaking across the sky in an hour's time. So it's a little bit hard to predict meteor showers. Predicting them is a lot like predicting the weather. It's at the end of the day, it's really a gamble.
And then when we talk about the Milky Way, Michael, what is this, if we're standing outside and if we're lucky enough to be in the Upper Peninsula, is it just that huge burst? Is that the Milky Way, that broad band, or where do we look?
Well, the Milky Way galaxy, when you talk about the Milky Way, they are referring to that stretch of what looks like a cloud stretching across the sky. But in truth, except for a few objects, everything you see in the nighttime sky is a part of the Milky Way galaxy. The stars that we can see that appear as pinpoints are just stars that happen to be close enough or bright enough to us that they appear that way. Stars that are much further away, our eyes have trouble resolving them into individual dots, and instead their light sort of mushes all together, and we perceive that as this big stretch of clouds across the nighttime sky, which we have called the Milky Way.
What about any dates that we should mark down for good watching in the sky?
Well, I'm gonna give you some dates that aren't in the summertime, but they bear mentioning because it could quite possibly be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Beginning in November, probably through January or February, we have a comet in the sky. It's called ISON, I-S-O-N, and it has the potential of being a comet that you can see with just your eyes alone. You won't even need a telescope. It'll be, for us, in sort of the end of the year, it'll be an early morning object, so you'll have to get up after midnight to see it. But it will hopefully, if the predictions hold true, be bright enough that you'll be able to see it with just your eyes alone.
How about the Northern Lights?
The Northern Lights. Well, we are entering into an active phase for our sun. And you might wonder, what does the sun have to do with Northern Lights? Well, the Northern Lights are actually caused by the sun. The sun will erupt, sending billions of tons of charged particles into the solar system. When those charged particles hit the Earth's magnetic field, they follow along the lines of the magnetic field and dump off their energy. And we perceive that here on planet Earth as these shimmering clouds of light, which we call the Northern Lights, or they also have them in the south called the Southern Lights. And we aren't able to predict them, but we do know that it takes about 2 days, 3 days or so for the particles to go from the sun to the Earth. So when we monitor the sun and we see one of these big eruptions, we can predict that perhaps in 2 or 3 days we have a good chance for seeing the Northern Lights.
And where in Michigan would be the best places? Certainly we know the UP seems to kind of have the crown for the best place for any and all stargazing. Where else would be good places to see the Northern Lights?
Well, anywhere it's dark. But sometimes if it's a particularly energetic set of Northern Lights, you don't even need it to be dark. I remember a few years ago I was coming out of a grocery store, walking in the parking lot, and I just happened to look up and there was this huge green shimmering curtain above me. Northern Lights have been seen as far south as Texas. It all depends on how energetic the storm is. But generally speaking, a good rule of thumb is the darker the better. So if you go as 20 miles or so away from the nearest city, you'll have the best opportunity to see virtually anything in the nighttime sky.
You know, I hear your enthusiasm, and certainly you have devoted your life to astronomy and to stars. What was it about the stars that drew you in, Michael, right at the beginning?
I spent some of my formative years growing up in Arizona, and I remember when I was 7 or 8, my dad would take my brothers and I out camping and sleeping under the stars, looking up and seeing, 10,000 dots in the nighttime sky. It was just awesome. It was inspiring.
And clearly a passion. Do you have any special things happening that we should know about at Cranbrook?
Well, astronomically speaking, we have a bunch of new planetarium programs that are set to debut in early July. We just completed a major renovation of our observatory, and that's open every Friday night, Saturday night, and also on the first Sunday of the month. We have 3 research-grade telescopes that we make available to the general public, and we will look at any and everything in the nighttime sky. It's computer-controlled, so anything anybody wants to see, we can quickly move the telescopes and point them at that particular object.
I did not realize you had these telescopes available for the public to enjoy.
Oh, absolutely. That's their prime use. Their prime use is for the general public and for school kids who come here on visits.
Michael Narlock, head of astronomy at the Cranbrook Institute of Science in Bloomfield Hills. Thanks so much for sharing your love of stars with us today.
Thank you.
Still to come, as we ready ourselves for Independence Day, we continue hearing stories from immigrants about what America means to them. Today, an Iranian woman who immigrated to the States in the 1970s. That story in 15 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you think about the government, local, state, federal, how much do you trust those leaders we've elected? Well, we certainly know public approval ratings for Congress are at abysmally low levels. Latest Gallup poll finds 78% of U.S. voters disapprove of the job Congress is doing. Only 17% approve. Let's look more closely at just what we all think about our leaders. Joining us here in the studio are Charlie Ballard. He directs the State of the State Survey for Michigan State University. And Tom Evacco, who does the Michigan Public Policy Surveys for the University of Michigan's Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy, CLOSUP. Tom, the last time we spoke, you gave us a snapshot of the state of trust between we the people and the leaders we've elected. Your newest survey looks at what Michigan's local government leaders think about the federal, state, and other local government leaders. So what did you find? How much trust is there?
Very little trust. So, yes, we asked local leaders all across the state how much of the time they trust the federal government, the state government, and local governments to do what is right. And what we found in 2013 is only 6% trust the federal government, nearly always or most of the time. So it's pretty down, not much, can't get much lower. It was 10% previously. It's down to 6% now. Pretty bad.
Somehow, I don't think that's what the Founding Fathers had in mind when this was all being constructed in 1776. Do you?
No. Although, of course, you know, I think, going all the way back to the founding of the country, you know, distrust of power, I think, is part of our political DNA. So I think it's built in to some degree. But we've seen over time a steep decline, and the decline continues today.
And over the years, how do you think this has changed?
Well, in the Michigan Public Policy Survey, it's relatively new. We started in 2009 asking local government leaders. And so we only asked this trust question once before, and that was in 2009. And what we found since then is, although we had low trust in the federal government then, we have less now. Towards the state government, it's a little more mixed. Republican and independent local leaders have more trust today than they did. Fairly marginal, but more. Democratic local leaders have less. And towards other local governments, it's about the same as it was before, overwhelming trust in other local governments.
All right. Now, Charlie Ballard, your latest State of the State survey looks at the level of trust that voters have in their local, state, and federal leaders. So what did you find?
Yeah. So we asked exactly the same questions, but we asked them of different populations. So the U of M survey is looking at the local officials themselves, and my survey is a random sample of about 1,000 just Michigan adults, ordinary folks. The trust was similar in terms of the state government. There were some partisan differences, but the overall level in each case, 19% said they trusted the state government nearly all or most of the time.
Okay.
Which is not fabulous, but
no.
It was similar for the two groups. Lower for the federal government, but the general public is not nearly as negative toward the federal government as the local officials are.
Interesting.
They have only 6% in the nearly all or most of the time. We had 15%. So our population's assessment of the federal is not all that different from the state. It's a little bit worse for federal, whereas the local officials, federal is a lot worse than state. But the biggest difference of all is in the assessment of the local. We asked, how do you like your local government? And the numbers were decent. 39% said nearly all or most of the time they'd trust, and only 21% said that they seldom or never trust their local. But that compares with 67% of the local officials who trust the local
yes.
government. So I think what it tells you is that the local officials, they sort of trust people like themselves.
Yeah, they all think they're doing a pretty good job.
yeah, and they think they're doing a pretty good job. And the public gives them higher ratings than they give either to the state or federal, but not nearly as high as they give to themselves.
There you go. There's the reality check from the view from the trenches, if you will.
The view from the trenches, exactly.
The homes. And Charlie, how has this changed? Are you seeing opinion trending one way or the other?
We've actually been doing this since 1995, so mm-hmm. we have a little bit more of a time trend. For the local government, it's almost unchanged. It's pretty flat. There's a very, very slight downward trend, but really it's stayed pretty stable. But for the state government, it's gone way down. It used to be that we had way more people saying that they trust state government nearly all the time than saying that they trust it seldom or never. That has reversed. The two lines crossed back in 2007.
Okay.
And right now we had in our most recent 19% with the sort of thumbs up and 31% with the thumbs down toward state government. And the rest of the people said they trust it some of the time, sort of a bland middle of the road kind of category. And the federal government had a big upsurge in trust right after 9/11. People were pleased. There was a sort of a national rallying around mm-hmm. in a time of crisis. And our trust in federal government went way up. And then it has come down pretty steadily since then. And so both for state and for federal, a pretty long-standing downward trend.
All right. Jump ball, whoever wants to kind of chime in on this. Why do you think this is?
Well, national opinion surveys on this go back to the early 1950s, and it's been a long-term slide since then. It was about 73% trusted state federal government nearly always or most of the time in the late 50s. And an awful lot of academic research finds, I think, a variety of reasons for this this declining trust. A lot of it seems to be based on the state of the economy. And when the economy is not doing well, people tend to trust their policymakers much less. And so I think that's at least part of what's going on over the last decade in Michigan.
So trust and approval kind of going hand in hand. We're
yes.
not happy at somebody. It might as well be the ones we've elected.
Exactly. After all, there are lots of reasons why you could say I don't trust somebody. One would be that you think they're corrupt or not transparent or something like that. But the other could be just that you're not happy with the situation. I think another one is that both for the state and for the federal government, we've seen a lot of dysfunction in recent years. That's not to say that we didn't have dysfunction before, but the partisan bickering and bitterness has certainly been pretty nasty in recent years, and I think that probably contributes to these declining numbers. The state government went from sort of net positive ratings to net negative 6 or 7 years ago. Well, that was at a time when, first of all, the economy was not doing well.
Mm-hmm.
But second, you remember the gridlock in Lansing between a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature that led to government shutdowns. That is not the kind of thing that inspires confidence among the public. And it was at that time that the state's numbers went dramatically south.
We're speaking with Tom Evacco, who does the Michigan Public Policy Surveys for the University of Michigan's Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy. And then that was Charlie Ballard speaking. He directs the State of the State Survey for Michigan State University. So let's talk about a big picture here, guys. Here we are. We're 16 months away from the midterm election for Michigan, so it's a big one. We have lawmakers in Lansing and in Washington who headed off on summer recess and left some big issues hanging out there in midair, Medicaid expansion here in Michigan, student loan interest rates, among other things in Washington. We have lousy approval and trust ratings. So overall, is this a healthy way to have things, Tom?
I don't think it is very healthy. I think there will always be some amount of distrust. There will always be some amount of dissatisfaction built in because politics is about winners and losers
sure.
most of the time. And so we're never going to get to 100% satisfaction or 100% trust. But it's gotten to, I think, such a state of dysfunction and fighting and arguing that I don't think it's healthy, certainly. Unfortunately, I also don't think this is making much of a difference in terms of political campaigns. Negative campaigning works.
Yeah, I want to echo some of the things that Tom has said. a healthy skepticism about government is absolutely essential. I mean, mm-hmm. our country was founded on dissatisfaction with the British government
Correct.
Under which we had lived. But when you get to a sort of a pathological distrust of government, that can be a problem. I think one of the problems that we face is that even though the legislators may know that there's general trust in government, they don't have to appeal to the public as a whole. They have to appeal to the people in their district, and in most cases their district is gerrymandered to guarantee a victory for their political party. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that they don't have to appeal to moderate or independent voters or people on the other side of the aisle. In an awful lot of cases, our legislators have this very real perception that they've just got to win their primary. And once they win the primary, they're in, because the game is rigged in terms of the drawing of the legislative district boundaries. Another one that my survey looked at a few years ago, we asked about would you be in favor of an independent nonpartisan commission to draw the district lines?
Yes.
Overwhelming public support for that. If it ever got to the ballot, of course, the elected legislators don't necessarily want to get it to the ballot. But if
yes.
it ever did get to the ballot, I believe that it would pass.
What do both of you think that the term limits in Michigan are doing to the competency levels of our legislature and back to this trust?
Disaster. It's hard to imagine a self-inflicted wound that could be more serious than this one, because you used to have people in Lansing who had an incentive to build up and maintain relationships, because you know that that other guy is going to be there 4 years from now, 6 years from now, mm-hmm. 10 years from now. Now that's gone. And also just the lack of experience. We have subcommittees of important legislative committees chaired by people who are in their first term.
Right.
And so I think it's a very unfortunate turn of events. I'd love to see some relaxation so that we could get a little bit more experience and also go back to building the long-term relationships. Mm-hmm. I had a conversation with two legislators one time, one from Democrat, mm-hmm. one from Republican. They worked for 8 years to get a piece of legislation passed. Well, with the 6-year term limit in the House, you don't even try.
Yeah, my take, I think I share a lot of Charlie's concerns about term limits. I was concerned before term limits that legislators were locked into place. Incumbents almost never lost seats. And so abuse of power, I think, you know, was an issue on a lot of folks' minds. So I think a lack of term limits is not necessarily an ideal world. I agree completely that I think current term limits in Michigan have played into some of the dysfunction and the partisan bickering. There really is no incentive to work long term. So I think that's a problem. I suspect that a lot of people in Michigan would support lengthening the terms, but I don't think there's support for removing term limits.
And we asked also a few years ago in my survey, well, what about – okay, right now it's 6 years in the House, 8 years in the Senate. What if it was 14 years total and you could be in either one? Well, that had majority support. Mm-hmm. We also asked, well, what if you get to your end of your term limit and then you could have to be out for 4 years, but you could come back? And that also had fairly substantial majority support. So people are at least amenable to some relaxation of these rules. And I'd love to see – I think almost any relaxation of our severe term limits would be a move in the right direction.
So looking at what we've been talking about, at the data you've both found in your surveys, give us your thoughts as far as the overall takeaway about feelings and about politics as we are here facing, you know, July 2013 in Michigan. Tom, I'll start with you.
I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction among Michigan's local government leaders, certainly, about the state of the nation and the state of our state of Michigan. I think it's based on a set of complex reasons. I think some local government leaders in Michigan are satisfied with some of the things that has been happening in state policy. State policymakers have passed some new policies that have strengthened local government, but at the same time they've cut revenue sharing. Mm-hmm. They have imposed additional unfunded mandates, which breaks the Constitution of Michigan. So I think it's a very complex picture among Michigan's local government leaders. But if we have to sum it up, not particularly good state of affairs overall.
And his survey is looking at the local leaders themselves. Mine is looking at the broader public. And certainly you don't see a huge amount of happiness with the way things are going. And you see these downward trends over time. And so if I were an official standing for election or for re-election in 2014, I would want to go in that with my eyes open and realize that the public is not all that happy. You're going to have to deal with, in many cases, people who are sort of negative and have developed over time a negative view of government generally. I think at least some of these folks may have a very positive view of particular aspects of government. For instance, there's not much trust in federal government, and yet most people think that Social Security and Medicare are good. But for the overall sort of view of government in general, there's a lot of distrust, and that's a serious problem for our public, I believe.
Interesting thoughts, and I know we are that this will not be our last conversation about these issues and about these attitudes. Tom Evacco, who does the Michigan Public Policy Surveys for the University of Michigan Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks.
And Charlie Ballard, who directs the State of the State Survey for Michigan State University. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Cindy.
This week on Stateside, as we prepare to celebrate the 4th of July, we're hearing stories from immigrants about what America means to them. Linda Steinke's family came to the U.S. from Iran in the 1970s when her father got the chance to work in the auto industry. These days, Steinke works as an interpreter at medical appointments. She says she often sees the person she might have become had she stayed in Iran in the people that she helps interpret for. Many of them come from war-torn nations and suffer from war-related injuries. Steinke says each and every day she feels grateful for the opportunity to be an American.
Assalamu alaikum. Ana ismi Linda, and I'm a tarjima lil mustashfa.
Okay, my name is Linda Steinke, and I'm an interpreter for University of Michigan Hospital. I interpret 4 different languages. I was born and raised in Iran, went to an Arabic school, grew up in a Christian Chaldean family, so I speak Chaldean.
Kabira, kabira, khebantam, sa'dan, nasha.
I not only interpret the language, but I also interpret the culture. We've had amputees, a burnt patient. We deal with cancer. One of the things is really amputees that when they come to this country, we have prosthesis, and they can really never have that back home. We've had a couple of patients that were hit by a missile and lost a leg. We were able to help them. And I look at that and I say, you know, I am so thankful that that could be me. Being an American means that I'm two people. I have two cultures. And I can help two different worlds. Because I lived in that other country. I know the culture, and I can understand people. Had I not been in America, I would definitely be in Iran. Who knows, I would probably be in the war, maybe killed, maybe tortured. Maybe depression would have killed me, because I would be forced to live the life that I don't want to live. My favorite part, being an American, is that I feel I'm free in this country. I can go out, buy medication. I can buy any kind of food that I want to. I have freedom, and I'm safe in this country.
This piece was produced by Michigan Radio's Kyle Norris. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered today by Peg Watson and Tony Brown. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Katie Theory, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.